This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I welcome the historian and narrator, Russell Shorto, distinguished for having written books about Manhattan, about the Revolutionary War, but now he takes us to a small town in western Pennsylvania, famous for a catastrophe, Johnstown. The catastrophe happened some years before our story. Nonetheless, it makes Johnstown a famous version of Americana between the Industrial Revolution and here we are in the 21st century. Russell, congratulations and good evening. The book is entitled Small Time. It is subtitled A Story of My Family, Your Family, Russell, and the Mob. We go to an event that was critical to the players in your book, October 30th, 1971. The Tribune Democrat, the Johnstown local newspaper, published 185 pages of a report issued by the federal government about organized crime. It read in part, during the course of that survey, commission investigators received allegations that a serious condition existed in the Johnstown area with regard to large-scale illegal gambling operations and the relationship to local government and law enforcement. One particular man named in this report, Joe Regino, whom we will introduce, called affectionately Little Joe, made a remark that he would have every Tribune Democrat destroyed. You report that you went looking for it in the town library and in the Tribune Democrat records. Did you find it, Russell? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Thanks for having me on your show. No, I didn't. Joe Regino, who was the boss of the operation of the local franchise of the mob in my hometown, Johnstown, indeed vowed that every copy of the Tribune Democrat he would destroy because it printed this about him. And he seems to have done it. I searched many other places as well. And finally, I went to the Tribune Democrat itself, and they had helped me a good deal in my research. And they let me roam through their archives, and there wasn't even a copy. That whole copy of the microfilm version of it, that whole reel was gone. So he was very thorough.
Very thorough. And that tells me that the work that you've done to assemble this, a time travel back, had to go through different generations' understanding of what is acceptable information and what is not to be talked about. Oftentimes I found myself in reading your book, Russell, aware of the fact that you were asking questions that had never been asked or were not appropriate, but you asked them anyway, of your own family and their friends. So as Joe Regino, Little Joe Regino, banished, we now go back to what appears to be the beginning. It's Sicily. It's the late 19th century in a place called San Pier Niceto. Do I say that correctly?
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty good.
All of Sicily is a very, very carefully organized to survive without modernity whatsoever. And that was especially true in San Pier Niceto. A young man, however, is beckoned to America. His name is Antonino. He is the patriarch of this whole story. Why does Antonino leave San Pier Niceto to go to America, Russell?
For the same reason that millions of others did at that time, poverty. And, you know, people don't really associate these two big forces that were going on the back of one another. You had in the 1860s the end of slavery in America. In the 1870s, you had the Risorgimento, the unification of Italy, finally, into one nation. When that happened, the North had always had this antipathy toward the South in Italy. When that happened, when they formed a nation, the North, the people of the North ran the country. They ran the government. And they made life even harder on Southern Italians, especially Sicilians, who they considered, they often see them referred to in the literature as Africans. That's what they, you know, which meant, you know, all everything lacking civilization. Life got even harder then. So meanwhile, you have in America all of these former plant, or these plantation owners who now need new labor, and they go to Sicily and they advertise on the streets. So the first of these immigrants who started coming were working in plantations, and then right after that in coal mines. And that's what that was the case with my great grandfather Antonino Sciotto, who answered a call to work in a coal mine in Pennsylvania.
He leaves behind a young wife, Francesca. And do they have children at this time when he leaves, Russell?
Yes, they had two children.
Right. And so he's going to send her money or send for her or something, but he's going off into the unknown. He's going to eventually western Pennsylvania into the coal mines. Initially, because before there was steel, there was coal. He leaves behind Francesca, and now we immediately plunge into some of the transformation. Antonino Sciotto, when he arrives, is that when they changed the name, right now, right then, or is it later?
It was later. He showed up first. His first job was at a coal mine outside of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and he worked there for a time himself, and he sent money home. And eventually, though, he sent for, I have to say, his girlfriend, because this his wife and children stayed in Sicily, but this girl from the village came, and he had sent for her, and she wrote down his address in Punxsutawney as the address she was going to. And they lived for a time together in Punxsutawney, and then they moved to Johnstown, to another town. And when they moved, they were no longer Antonino Sciotto and Anna Maria Previte. Suddenly in Johnstown, they show up as Tony and Mary Sciotto. So they did this change of personalities, almost of names, and suddenly, and from that moment on, they were a married couple.
To your
without ever having gotten married.
To your understanding, how did Antonino, Tony, how did he derive the name Sciotto? Did he do it? An official do it? Because the legend is that officials did it at when people landed in America.
Right. Typically, I think that's the case. I think it was probably an official because, as far as I know, they couldn't write. But if you, the name was Sciotto, and it was pronounced Sciotto. And if you say that with an Italian
right.
accent, Sciotto, and an American hears it, they might very well write Sciotto, which is how my name is today, S-H-O-R-T-O. So I think that's how it happened, and they ran with it.
It is the beginning of the 20th century now, and after the flood of 1889, killed 2,000 people, the third most Americans ever wiped out in a day, the opening for U.S. Steel and Bethlehem Steel that now dominate the commerce of Johnstown. It's prospering. There are big houses, there are bosses, there are owners, and then there are the workers. And there lives Tony Sciotto and Anna Maria Sciotto having babies, having baby girls. What of Francesca? What do we know of her? And Tony visited her. What do we know of those visits? Did he send her money?
He went back several times, and that was typical of the immigrants. Remember, you keep in mind there were about 4 million people immigrated from southern Italy to the U.S. in this time period, and often they didn't consider themselves immigrants. They were going, you know, sort of like in later times, Mexicans would come to the U.S. work and then go back when they could and send money home. That was very much the pattern. And presumably he was going back not just to see his mother, but to see his wife and children too. So he was living this, you know, you try to put yourself in the head of this guy who's living this kind of, you know, on the margin existence, trying to support families in two countries.
And he has money because the wages are very good compared to what you can earn in the old world. This is the new world. Daughters arrive in Johnstown, daughters and sons arrive in San Pier Niceto. I want to say that both these families are depending upon Antonino's largesse. In one visit, I believe it's 1908, I believe this, my notes are incomplete sometimes, help me, Russell. He goes because he thinks his mother's ill and something catastrophic happens to him. What do we know of it?
He goes back on one trip, and he was apparently kind of showing off. You know, he took people out. This was on his departure, on the, returning back to America.
This is 1920, and I believe, 1920.
This is 1920, and he takes people out there dressed up. He takes people out to a restaurant, and it was clear that he was someone who had money. And he was, at some point, attacked and murdered. And that was the end of him. And suddenly, then he's, his wife in America, who was my great-grandmother, is left with nine children, and she doesn't speak English, and she has to figure out a way to get by.
It's 1920. We're in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. There are nine children, mostly girls, but there's two boys and one particular one particular boy we're going to follow when we come back. Russell Shorto is the author. This is history, Russell's history, but it's also Johnstown's history. It's America's history. Small Time, a story of my family and the mob. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. Russell Shorto's here to help me tell a story that solves much of where America comes from, the ambitions of young men and women who travel to America for work and establish families and marry and have children. In this particular case, it's the very famous Johnstown, Pennsylvania, the steel mills of Johnstown that becomes the arsenal of democracy of Johnstown some decades later. However, we leave this threatened family of nine children and Anna Maria, who is called Maria, Russell's great-grandmother. She must make do with no income. There's no welfare going on. We seize on one of her children to follow for the rest of this story, Rosario, who is called Russell, your namesake. He's born in 1914. What did he remember of his father's death, of being told of his father's death? Is there a family story about that, Russell?
Well, the family stories are, that's really what I have to go on, and that he was beaten up and murdered because of the bankroll, the money that he had on him. And so from that moment, he was 6 years old when his father died, and he was the oldest boy, and he becomes, as it were, the man of the family. And that coincides very neatly with the beginning of Prohibition in America. Right. And that then becomes an income stream for his mother, for his family, and for millions of other people in the country, because suddenly you have a product everybody in the country seems to want, and the businesses that had been set up to provide it suddenly are out of business. So, like many others, Mary sets up a still in her house, and there is a local man, kind of a neighborhood protector boss, Italian man, who apparently urged her and told her how to do it, and did likewise for others in the neighborhood. And so there she is cooking up moonshine, and her boy is out on the streets with Coke bottles full of it, selling it. And that's how he learns the ropes.
In other words, enterprise. I also was charmed by the fact that they keep a pig under the porch, and it gets so big they have to take the porch apart to get it out.
That was one of those stories that everybody passed down. Yeah, I think that would have been a memorable incident, especially when you're a child.
The girls are named Anna, Perina, Angeline, Sarah, Carmela, Catherine, and Nancy. And the two boys are Rosario, called Russell, and Anthony, called Tony, I can imagine. However, we're going to follow Russell, born 1914, and Carmela, called Millie. She's an important factor here because later she will marry Joe Regino, the man we started with. This is one great big family that takes care of itself through the, what you'd have to say, turbulence of American history. Now, it is the 1920s. Mary remarries one of her boarders, I believe, and is a survivor. And her family is learning to survive as well. Rosario, Russell, is growing up without a father. You make it very clear that he finds a father figure to give him guidance. I believe his name is Verone. Yeah, Philip Verone.
That's right.
Who is he?
He was a local, you know, this was he was apparently a Black Hand leader. And Black Hand, it's a little, that term is murky, the way, if you look up the Black Hand and what it was. It was kind of an extortion, pre-mafia extortion group. A lot of the old guys I talked to in town, they kind of looked at it differently. It was a little bit more like, these guys are looking out for us. So he was this, as I say, kind of a neighborhood leader. And they were, you know, so this is a time when prohibition, so alcohol is kind of the income stream. And at the same time, gambling is huge in America, and it's, you know, gambling is what is going to become the next income stream, and it's hard to wrap your head around it, because everything then that they were doing, that Russ was going to be doing, involved gambling, and it's all legal today. You know, I mean, the states control it. But then it was such a vice, such an immoral activity, that it had to be done kind of in the back streets. And Philip Barone then teaches Russ as a kid, takes him under his wing, and teaches him a lot of things. But the things I know about are teaching him how, teaching him the ins and outs of not just gambling, but cheating. And that's kind of the extra twist in the story, that my grandfather became really kind of a world-class cheat at cards and dice. And I think, in a way, that was really his métier.
Well, he's surviving in a landscape that's changing quickly, because we go from prohibition and the turbulence of being left without a husband or a breadwinner or anything in a steel town to the Great Depression that shuts down almost everything. All commerce seizes up. And Johnstown itself, it takes a pause in its prosperity. It is now the end of prohibition. In 1933, FDR is there, but there's very little work. And Russell, having learned to run liquor, bootlegged liquor, and now having learned to throw the dice, I think that was his chief activity, although you tell me that he was also practiced cards. He knew how to deal cards very cleverly. So there are a lot of skills here. The question here is, when does he turn to organized crime? And it happens quite naturally. We go back to Carmela, Millie, one of the younger daughters, not the youngest, somewhere in the middle. She meets a man named Joe, who will become Joe Regino. How do they meet, Russell?
She worked at a little kind of a candy store at the edge of Central Park. People would go there and buy popcorn and feed it to the pigeons, that kind of thing. And Joe Regina, so we're describing Russ growing up in the sort of prohibition and then gambling world in my hometown in western Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, this other guy comes of age in the nascent mob in Philadelphia. And, that, you know, one of the fascinating things about researching the American Mafia to me is how it took on the features of American capitalism. These guys just admired the, you know, the Fricks and the Carnegies and the Fords and all of that. And they then began to open up branch offices. So he was sent from Philadelphia. He was kind of given the job of opening the franchise in Johnstown, this booming steel town. He shows up, happens to go into this little shop, meets Millie, and you know, the story in the family later was he kept going in to buy sodas to in order to talk to her, and then he, you know, couldn't drink anymore at some point. So he meets her, falls in love with her. He's there to open the kind of what was going to be a gambling operation in town, and lo and behold, her brother already knows that whole side of the town from the ground up.
We've got Russell and Joe together. This is important now. It's the late 1930s. The book is Small Time, a story of my family and the mob by Russell Shorto. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. Russell Shorto. His new book is Small Time, a story of my family and the mob. It's also a story of Americana, from migration to enterprise to criminality to transforming the landscape to memory. That's where we are in the 21st century. It is now the late 1930s. Millie and Joe are together after Joe does a time in bars. Millie goes, takes him home to Johnstown. She doesn't like Philadelphia. It's too big. It's too noisy. Joe is now partnering with Russell, and their partnership will be extremely successful. Russell, I want to understand these partnerships. They were never independent agents. It seemed that they were always connected to larger and larger versions of themselves. So Joe Regino and Russell Shorto, they will find an enterprise called City Cigar, but they don't do that independent of larger organized crime. Do they relate to Philadelphia or Pittsburgh at this point? How is Johnstown connected to the web of organized crime?
Yeah, Johnstown was connected to Pittsburgh, and then Pittsburgh was connected to New York. That's the way, you talked about, you mentioned the structure of it. And it's interesting, it's hard to grasp because there was a structure, but it wasn't hard and fast. It was always fluid, but that was the basic, the small city fed into the bigger city, which fed into, the mother city. And that's the overall operation. As you say, once they were setting up their operation in town, the base of it was a place called City Cigar, which was two doors from City Hall. And the front of it was a little cigar shop, and there was a door behind that. You walked through that into a pool hall. And upstairs were offices. They ran a numbers operation. That was the center of their business, which half the town played. They ran card games for the big shots in town. They ran, there were dice games for the regular mill workers. They had pinball. Pinball was people gambled on pinball. It was huge. According to the American Pinball Museum, there was more money spent on pinball than on the movies at this time. And they did something called chip seals, which was kind of like a lottery. You bought one and you tore it off. And if your number matched the number underneath, then you won a buck or whatever.
I don't mean to go too fast because there are intricacies here. I want to mention that a significant player turns up in 1937, before the war, before the end of the Depression, before Joe goes into the military in Louisiana, and Russell stays at home to be a war worker, meaning critical. The significant player is Mary. She turns up in 1937 working in a cafe in Johnstown. Russell falls in love with her. What is the major attraction to our understanding of your grandfather and grandmother?
Well, he was, this up-and-coming kind of a bad boy, so I guess that was an attraction. He was also a really smart guy. She had had her own very difficult upbringing, and she left her family home and went to New York City and lived there for about 10 years, working as a waitress at Child's Restaurant, which was kind of the first chain restaurant in America. And so she finally then came back and got a job at a local restaurant. And everybody said that she had, because she'd spent so long in the big city, she had this sophistication about her. She bought herself nice clothes. She knew how to wear them, knew how to wear her hair in the latest fashion. So that would have been naturally appealing to him.
The first child is born in 1938, Antonino. Tony, your father, Russell, he's born into an environment that's changing very quickly in the course of his youth, because at the end of the war, that's when the opportunity that is City Cigar, later expanding into different floors of the same building. They had, I write down here, they had the Melody Lounge, they had a bowling alley, they had a boxing ring. Today, of course, they'd own a mall. That's what they'd be doing today. Several malls. They'd network. But in those days, you just owned one building with different floors. However, this is organized crime, and the money now at City Cigar is prodigious, running from the 1945 on. What about the authorities? You mentioned one particular, Detective Carroll, I believe his name is. There are a lot of arrests between 45 and 46, and then Russell's not arrested again. Why do we think that's true?
It was fascinating doing the research for this book because I was in my hometown interviewing all the old people basically I could find in my family and out, because everybody above a certain age knew the story, knew the people. It's a small town. And I did it with my dad. My dad was in his early 80s, and we spent a few years together doing this work, trying to uncover his father and his life. And we made this really memorable father and son trip to the county courthouse, where we requested my grandfather, his father's arrest records. And we got this stack of them. And they're all for gambling. The first one's for running a card game out of the trunk of a car. But as you say, they stopped. And they stopped because they had figured it out. Russ and Joe had figured out the system. And the system was you pay off the mayor, you pay off the cops, and you create this kind of protective umbrella over the operation. And from that moment, and this is the late 40s, the mid to late 40s after the war, that's when everything really starts. They've got their system down. They have their protective umbrella over them, and they begin to proliferate with these different kinds of offering these, you know, like Las Vegas, like the state lotteries, offering how many different ways can I tempt you to give up your money.
March of 1951, a young politician named Estes Kefauver enters the picture. What is his mission, and how does it affect Joe and Russell and the operation?
Throughout the 50s, you have this interesting situation where the mob is rising in America. And, you know, the backstory to my book is everybody knows the mob. They think of New York and Philly and Chicago. But it was in every city of any size. It was in Scranton and in Johnstown and in Amarillo and in Fresno. And it was connected. And law enforcement, there were people who were starting to get a handle on that. And Estes Kefauver is one of those politicians who says, you know, we have to treat this as a national problem, as a federal problem. J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, for whatever combination of reasons, and, you know, at the time, he was all-powerful. He refused for a long time to see that. He was focused on communism. He had his kind of template, his worldview of what was important. And so the Kefauver hearings were the beginning of awareness, and they were televised. And so people in their homes were starting to – they were starting to put together, you know – people in Johnstown and other towns all across the country knew that these guys were running these kinds of operations because everybody played the numbers, and they were starting to connect the dots from that to what they were talking about in these hearings, that it wasn't just this thing happening downtown at the cigar store or whatever. It was connected to a larger entity.
The entity, of course, had all these romantic names, the mob, mafia, Cosa Nostra, but we're following a family. And the success and eventual failure of one particular member of the family, Russell, who's going through these changes with a lot of money in his pocket. And you write about how sometimes Mary and Russell would go off to Atlantic City and spend a lot of money. But there are shadows here, and part of the shadows are this changing scene of the commission. Estes Kefauver, but you will remember, was nominated to be a vice presidential candidate with Adlai Stevenson in 1956. So this is a major story. In 57, there's the famous meeting of the mob in a little town called Appalachian, I believe. And that gains a great deal of attention. And there's pressure, always pressure on what looks like a small business, which is policy or running numbers and gambling. I'm speaking with Russell Shorto, the author of the new book, Small Time, A Story of the Mob and My Family. And when we come back, murder. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm speaking with the author, Russell Shorto. His new book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. We come now to an event that's important to mention, because I want to get back to the family, but I want to frame this. There's a murder, and the murder takes place off camera. We don't see it, but Russell's done the best he can to put together why it happened and what it did to the operation. His name was Pippi DeFalco. This is the year, I believe, is 1960. Is that correct, Russell? February 60.
Yeah.
Why do we believe he was murdered, and they found his body later that spring coming up out of the river. And that rocked everybody and seems to have been the beginning of the end of happy times. Why was he killed? Who killed him?
Well, the murder was never solved. When I first started meeting with people in town and saying, you know, I want to look into my grandfather. I want to understand who he was and what that world was. Invariably, each of one of these old people who I sat down with would say, you know the story about Pippi, right? So, I mean, it's still to this day that story echoes in town. That he was a bookie, he booked sports, he worked at times for Russ and Joe, but it also at times he would go out on his own. And apparently, and this may have been his undoing, he would also at times work for one of the neighboring operations in Greensburg or McKeesport or New Kensington. And one of the reasons that this becomes such a big local mystery is that he goes missing. The body doesn't turn up for about 6 weeks. And in that interval, you see it in the paper. They're saying, where's Pippi? What happened to Pippi? Who's Pippi? He's this local bookie. And he was working for the boys. And by the way, what are they doing? Why are we allowing this to happen? Why are we allowing this kind of operation to go on in public? This is against the backdrop of the campaign for a president in 1960. And John F. Kennedy ultimately wins, of course, and he brings in his brother, Bobby Kennedy, to be attorney general. And Bobby Kennedy now, you know, a while ago you were asking about Kefauver. Now, by 1960, that push to have the federal government step in and try to root out this organized crime is a mission. It's Bobby Kennedy's mission. And so suddenly, eventually they find the body of Pippi DeFalco. He was stabbed in the chest with something like an ice pick, so clearly murdered. So suddenly you have these events at the national level converging with what's going on in this little town, and you have the Attorney General of the United States communicating with the mayor of this town, and you've got FBI agents in town. So this then applies this pressure, unlike anything that had happened before, on Russ and Joe and their operation. And as you say, it spells the beginning of the end of what they created.
Secrets and deceptions and cheating. Russell mentions cheating and living several lives at once. What you do and you can't talk about, what you talk about, you can't show to people because they might turn on you. All of that puts an enormous amount of tension into all these relationships. And I cannot possibly explicate them. Russell has done a wonderful job over many years to sort this out. However, Russell Shorto, the grandfather, is acting out in ways that are recognizable except for the fact that he's a member of organized crime. There are several very strong women whom he exploits or who he has incomplete and broken relationships with. There are children born out of wedlock that everybody knows about and nobody talks about until Russell Shorto, the author, comes along and asks stories. There are wonderful women who recount everything long afterwards, including Russell, your grandmother. I loved her and her dog, Bibi, telling you stories and making you little meals with you and Bibi in front of the television. These are intricate family stories, but I want to stay with Russell because he's the fascination. He's the child born in 1914 who shoulders for his mother this family that's threatened in Johnstown. Russell drank. Your father drank. And that is a burden on them and on the whole families. But did your father come to some revelation in the course of these investigations about Russell, about what the alienation and the tension? I want to determine that the author believes that your father learned and passed away with at least some grace about his father's own conduct.
I think that's true. The point you just made, my father agreed to work with me on this, because he wanted to help me. And also because he at one point he said to me, he never broke cover. He's talking about his own father. Right. Like, you know, he never really knew who his father was, which is remarkable. And so he, I think, was also doing this exploration with me to try to understand more. But he had, my father had long since forgiven his father, who, as you say, created all of this turmoil in the family. I think my family, you know, my family always, I grew up with this awareness of my grandfather as this, as a mob figure, but, and there was always this kind of darkness and whispers around the mention of his name. But I think that was, they would have been okay with him, you know, running a numbers game or something. It was that other stuff. It was the womanizing and the having children, and then not only having children with a woman, but deciding, okay, you can't raise him, so I'll give this child to someone else. And then this drinking, this binge drinking and the blackouts and, you know, just that kind of havoc that it played in a family, which, you know, it happens to happen in this, with this mob context, but that can happen in any family. And those are the sort of things that really, really stay with it and carry on into the next generation. And that's what, my father and I, in a sense, were dealing with as we were, moving through this material.
I don't want to do psychology. I want to do opera, because I thought of Russell as an opera figure. And I always picture him, born 1914, 6 years old, his father's dead. And he takes on a responsibility that no 6-year-old can possibly manage. Nobody. No, a 16-year-old, a 36-year-old cannot manage a family of 9 with no source of income, and a woman who's determined to survive in a country where she does not speak English. Did we mention that? Did we emphasize? Anna Maria spoke only a few phrases at the end of her life, and she survived, and Russell had to be a reason for her survival. I don't know about the alcohol. That's probably just doing business, but he had the sickness, and we understand about alcoholism. But the networking he did, he was a corporate man, Russell. That's what I said before that was available to Italian immigrants. We've not emphasized the prejudice towards the Italians. You mentioned it when they first were invited to America in the early part of the 20th century, but that prejudice survived. Well, how long is it? It might still be with us, that there's something different about the Italians, or there's reason to suspect the Italians. And your grandfather had to survive in that. Do I read correctly that it was the context of that city cigar?
You're absolutely right. The prejudice we didn't mention strongly enough up to now. You've got two things. You've got American immigration, come here because we need you to do work that we don't want to do. And then you've got the prejudice, you know, suddenly we don't like these people who are from somewhere else who don't speak the language properly. And all importantly, because America thought of itself very much as white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation, they were Catholic. And that was a big thing. You know, people were, I mean, in the 1920s, when people were fed up with all these, not just Italian, but Irish immigrants and Poles and Hungarians. That's when you have the return of the Ku Klux Klan. And you've got these big parades in Washington and New York, the men in their white robes and the whole deal. And it's against the Catholics. And in this case, in particular, against these Southern Italians. And that helps to give rise to the American Mafia, because they were discriminated against. They couldn't pursue, you know, the kinds of jobs, the kinds of careers that might be open to other Americans. And yet they were given that as models. You know, the men of business, the titans of industry, they were their models. So in a way, in a remarkable way, the American Mafia is a mirror of American capitalism.
And City Cigar represents the center of a completely transparent organization if you're inside the organization. I think one of the reasons we puzzle about Pepe DeFalco is that he was skimming, wasn't he? And somebody caught him at it, and he paid for it, but we don't know who. Is that how you understand Pepe?
That's one logical, maybe the most logical explanation of why he was killed. It's also possible he was known around town as he'd like to be a ladies' man. He had a wife at home, but he'd like to, you know, impress the ladies. And one way he did it was he always carried a big bankroll, because he was, you know, the nature of his business. But people said he would carry like thousands of dollars, which in 1960 was an awful lot of money. So it's possible he was just murdered, and that, you know, that then, since he happened to be a figure in that world, helped to touch off all of these, start all the dominoes falling.
The generations are gone. but Russell's here to remember them. The book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.